Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
We could start today's episode with a compilation of money-related hit music. Think about Kendra and Abbe's Money Makes the World Go Round from Cabaret, ABBA's Money, or Dire Straits' Money for Nothing. Doing so would surely lead to a rights issue, so we stuck to our own tune. But it is true that the world revolves around money. And one thing that both the financial system and the data system have in common is that both also require consumer trust. The U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, is the independent agency created to maintain stability and public confidence in America's financial system. They insure deposits and examine and supervise financial institutions, among many other things. In Europe, probably most of this role would be undertaken by national banks and the European Central Bank. Our guest today is the Chief Innovation Officer for the FDIC. Sultan Mehji is part of the team that works on the future of banking, which includes all kinds of digital financial services. Before joining FDIC, Sultan was chairman and CEO at Neocova, an AI-focused fintech firm that he established. Furthermore, he is a professor at Washington University in St. Louis, as well as a scholar for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So once again, we won't have a lack of issues to discuss. My name is Paul Breitbart.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. I'm so thrilled to have my friend Sultan here that I completely was not looking up the unexpected questions. Here's one. All right, Sultan, thank you for joining us. I'm going to get totally into the totally being thrilled to have you here. And oh my gosh, how exciting is your new position. But first, most importantly, the unexpected question. You ready?
Always.
He's just grinning at me. What topic are you bored talking about?
That's a great question, Kay. And let me say, it's great to see you again after, I will say, more than a few years since you and I met at the FBI Citizens Academy, which was a heck of a lot of fun and a great way to get back to our communities. And Paul, it's wonderful to meet you on this forum. I would say the thing that I'd like to actually turn the question around and talk about things I'm not tired of talking about, which is how important resilience is to the banking system of the United States. And that is the something that we as regulators, but also across the entire ecosystem, I feel like we could never spend too much time talking about it, raising the awareness or even just actually getting something done.
I like that part.
Yeah. I really do want to answer your question, but the fact is I'm just a few weeks into this new role. It's my first time in public service. I have figured out where the paperclips are, but beyond that, I think there's still a lot to come. I feel like every time I do press, or I was just talking to some people on the Hill earlier today, and I need to preface everything I say with, I have no major policy announcements today, and the views presented here are my views and not the views necessarily of the agency I work for or, you know, the U.S. government as a whole.
I love it. So let's go from a personal level then. What are you tired talking about? Because most people I know are sick and tired of talking about the new norm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know what's interesting? I talk to a lot of people and they think that the last year has been an aberration and that we're going to go back to normal. I hear a lot of people saying we're going to go back to normal. And I would argue that we are in a new normal, and next year there will be a new normal after this, and the year after that, and the year after that. And I think those of us who live in the transformative side of our civilization realize that things change at a fairly regular pace, and that in some cases it's an isolated set of changes, and in other cases it's a very broad set of changes. And I think we're now seeing that broad changes are going to be coming faster and more furious than ever. That's the one that I would like to see us turn the corner on. You know, for all that we seem to be seeing the light at the end of the tunnel on the current pandemic, the fact that we might have to deal with this again in the future, we have to think about that, right? So, you know,
right.
And as we go down this path, moving to more digital environments means that we have to really look at the resilience of a lot of different systems that we haven't had to look at previously. You know, obviously, I spent a lot of time looking at the banking sector, and there's been a lot of great work done over the last few years, but there's been more change in that system in the last couple of years than in the last couple of decades. And you know, there's a lot we need to continue to do.
That is true. So, Paul, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, you can go first if you want to.
If you tell me you're tired of talking about privacy, I'm just going to shut the video off and we're done.
No chances there. Also, no chance that I would be tired of talking about Shrimps 2 or the Shrimp Stew, as Omer Tene now calls it, because of automatic translations in video. No, that's not it. I'm tired of talking about COVID, but that's probably everybody. And I'm pretty tired of talking about the populist right. As you may recall from last week, we are in the midst of an election campaign here in the Netherlands. We have our general election on March 17, and media are giving way too much attention to the populist right. They're once again gaining lots of seats in our house, and I'm not too excited about that. But maybe let's try just for a while just to ignore them.
Yeah, I get it. So I will say for myself that I was just talking about this to someone else, and it's not something that I'm tired of talking about, but something that comes up in that conversation is that privacy professionals that are living this every day get tired of talking about some of the more popular topics because we feel like we've talked it to death, such as the CCPA or the CPRA or the Privacy Shield. We're like, oh my gosh, right? I don't want to talk about that anymore. Since we live it and breathe it, exactly, we don't think about how many people actually don't live and breathe this, and they're starving for information on these topics, and we just happen to be drowning in them. So I have to keep that perspective top of mind, that just because we live it and breathe it doesn't mean that others do.
No, that's absolutely true. So let's dive a bit more into privacy. Kay, you mentioned, and Sultan mentioned as well, that you two met before at an FBI academy. Tell me more about that. What is the FBI academy?
Go ahead, Sultan.
So Kay and I met, 2007, something like that. It was a little while ago. The FBI Citizens Academy is an outreach program run by the FBI to kind of show how they do what they do to take care of us, protect us, keep our country safe. And you get basically nominated to participate. And then you go through an abbreviated version of the same agent training program that normal agents go through in their training. And so you learn everything from investigative techniques to lectures from people on everything from identity theft to improvised explosive devices. We did a couple of really cool little field trips. We went to a maximum security prison. We got to have a day on the range, which was, I think, a highlight for some of us. And basically, it's like being inside an episode of one of those TV shows where you get to see the FBI agents running around doing all the cool stuff. But it's just a bunch of us.
I was just going to ask, is it anything like you see on TV?
It's actually cooler than what you see on TV.
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
And I will say that two things that stand out to me is three things that really stood out to me about the Citizens Academy, and I'm actually on the board for it, is that the demonstration when we were out at the range where they showed their team that comes in and takes over a building or clears a building, it is so silent. You could hear a pin drop from them clearing a building. It is absolute silence. And you always expect, like you see in the movies, to be all the noises, and it's not. The other was how they tracked down a child pedophile online and showed us how fast the child pedophiler tracked down the child and how they found out information about the child, the child's parent, where they live, what school. And within the same day, the pedophile was sitting outside the child's school, but the FBI was sitting there waiting on him. And it was amazing to see that. And then the other was the only time FATS is fun. They have an electronic firearms training system called FATS. And you go through a simulation where they react to whatever you do. So if you do or don't do something right, certain things happen. And I recall mine because since I'm Southern, they gave me the shotgun scenario. And I didn't think it was a shotgun. The person was picking up behind the gun. So behind the door, I thought it was a baseball bat. So I didn't holler gun and got my partner killed.
Oops.
Just saying.
But to be fair, it wasn't me. But to be fair, that wasn't me. So I'm okay with that.
It was an FBI agent. It was an FBI agent. I got killed. It's okay. It's fine. But what was really cool for that is that you do get to meet the people in the class with you. We had the first foreign diplomat in our class. It was from Canada, the first one that the FBI had had in a Citizens Academy. And then you meet really cool people like Sultan that you stay friends with for forever. And then they get like elevated to these glorious positions. The first chief innovation officer at the FDIC. I mean, wow, Sultan, I'm genuflecting to you here. This is wow.
Okay, so what does that mean?
Tell us
about it. What does your job description say?
You know, the most interesting thing about the government is the job description is 80 or 90 pages long. So I will try to give you a TLDR on that. If you listen to or read what the chairman has been talking about for the last few years, is she's been a huge proponent of innovation in the sector and in the regulatory community. And what does that mean? It means that we are more innovative, that we keep technology at the forefront, just like it is across the rest of the market, and that we build an agency for tomorrow that supports the banking system of tomorrow. And, you know, I'll give you some numbers. I'm in government now, so I love numbers, right? In the 1980s, there were roughly 18,000 banks in the United States. Now it's about 5,000. Okay. There's a order of magnitude more capital in the system than there was. A average checking account in the 1980s in the United States would have maybe 20, maybe 30 transactions in a month. And it would be either cash or check, right? Nothing real time, nothing digital. Now it's hundreds of transactions per month per person across a variety of different platforms, some inside the regulatory system, just like a bank or Zelle or whatever. And in many cases, outside of the regulatory system, you know, through a fintech, you know, either US or maybe European based. And so, you know, I tend to talk about a couple of things that we're going to be thinking about. So obviously, first is making sure that we're building a diverse, equitable, and inclusive banking system for the future. You know, I'm focused exclusively on American citizens and making sure that they have access to the best banking products and services that fit their needs. Okay, so that's the first one. The second is making sure that the system is resilient, that it's supportive. We have the most stable, most powerful banking system and have for generations here in the United States. And we have a very keen focus on ensuring it stays that way. The third is amplification. And you know, you can dig that out of, you know, considering things like the fourth industrial revolution or just the ever increasing amount of technology in the system. You know, the technologies of the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, even 2010s are all significantly different from each other and then also different from what we do today. You know, 20 years ago, we weren't talking about artificial intelligence. We weren't talking about real-time cyber events. We weren't looking at the ripples of these interconnected systems. That's a big thing we have to consider. And we need to make sure that we're amplifying the people so that people are getting their jobs done, doing the work they're supposed to be doing, both inside the system as well as, you know, all the way out to the average American consumer or small business owner. But then also making sure that it's, you know, they're efficient about it, you know, not beating a keyboard against the wall trying to manhandle a spreadsheet for 45 minutes to spend 90 seconds actually doing the work they need to do. And then finally, we do have to consider what the next few decades of evolution in this space are going to look like and begin to position ourselves from a policy, guidance, procedures, et cetera, perspective. You know, cybersecurity is going to continue to be a bigger issue. The threats of identity, as you guys have highlighted previously, and will continue to do, I'm sure, continue to go up, mm-hmm. right? The malicious actors in the space have more advanced technology available to them on a daily basis. I was just actually earlier today talking about what ransomware as a service is to someone and helping them understand that, you know, you can do more things with your smartphone in your hand today than a lot of people could have done 6, 12, 18 months ago with access to a supercomputer. So, you know, there's a lot we have to consider there. And so to get back to your question, you know, my remit is to take all the good work that's already being done, consider all of the things I just described, and build a set of programs to make sure we're attacking all of these head on. So it's a very long answer. You can tell I've transitioned into government, right?
Well, and I'm sure you've had this question quite a few times over the past couple of months, but just to help my understanding, because I'm not that familiar with the FDIC, it is like a kind of oversight body, right, for the financial market.
Yeah.
So you are trying to predict what the market will be, say, 5 years from now.
So let me tell you about the FDIC, Paul. So it's great. So unlike in Europe and other parts of the world where there are singular regulatory bodies, you know, the ECB is an example or something like that. Or here in the United States, we have a federated regulatory system, right? Every state has its own capability to have a regulatory body, and all of them do. And then at the federal level, it's been broken up amongst a number of agencies. And so you have some agencies like the Federal Reserve, which in many ways operates like a central, just like a traditional central bank, but it also operates as a regulatory function. And it also is a technology provider. They run a payments network. You have the OCC, which is another regulatory agency. You have CFPB, you have a whole bunch of these other ones. The FDIC is one of these bodies, and it's specifically focused on a subset of the total banking system in the United States. Now, it just happens to be the biggest subset. It's you know, roughly 85% of all the banks in this country. And it has a couple of features. One is it is an insurance body. So when you're an American citizen and you can sleep at night knowing that your bank accounts are protected, insured, and taken care of by the US government, that's us. Right. So you see that little plaque, you know, on your bank that says this account is insured up to $250,000. That's us. The second thing is,
although it's not necessarily backed by gold anymore.
Well, I don't think I'm the person you should be talking to about the questions around when we went off the gold standard in 1972 and moved to fiat currency, or the impacts of why that's such an interesting conversation today.
You know, people still think their money is insured by actual gold that's held in Fort Knox. I'm just saying.
You know, that's not been true for
a long time,
almost 50 years at this point. I certainly have some personal thoughts about how we could do a better job of educating people as to how the financial system actually works. But Paul, the other half of one of the things to worth highlighting about what we do is we're the ones that go out and make sure the banks are being run correctly. We look at how they're operating. We have a regular series of examinations, as we call them, to ensure that they're kind of playing by the rules and doing things the right way. And there's a lot of work that goes on there. It's everything from, you know, making sure their balance sheets are managed correctly and are correct, to making sure the trend lines are correct, to, you know, even making sure that as they implement technologies, that they're doing it in a secure and thoughtful way. You know, I mean, I'll give you an example. Something that hit my desk recently was updating some discussions around multi-factor authentication, which is something that should absolutely be true of every bank. And you know, we certainly embrace that view.
Just looking at you, Kate.
So that was one of the things that I was going to ask was, so when you manage the oversight of the banks and the technologies, are you taking a privacy and security, cybersecurity oversight of them as well? And if so, it sounds like you are. And if so, are you actually endorsing or requiring anything like data protection impact assessments or annual reviews, anything operational like that?
Absolutely. There's a lot that's already in guidance and writing right now. And some of it's from us. Some of it's us partnering with other regulatory bodies, with the states. There's quite a bit there. Now, just like in anything else in cybersecurity, you can't just publish something, throw it over the wall, and, you know, kind of just, you know, hope that it goes well, right? You have to update it, you keep on it, right? And that's something that I think, you know, you were talking about people who still think we're on the gold standard. You know, that's something that you know, is kind of a challenge, is a lot of people, both in the private sector and in the public sector, don't kind of realize the cadence of change, the cadence that you have to put into ensuring that you're managing, you know, your cybersecurity risks the right way and in a thoughtful way. I'm glad that you highlighted that I'm a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment. One of the big projects I've worked on is something called the FinCyber Program. It's specifically focused on, you know, kind of providing tools across globally to help people understand that, to help people communicate it, to make sure that we're talking about it at the right levels, and that, you know, everything from, you know, governments and people inside of, you know, people, elected officials inside of the government, all the way through to boards of directors at companies are kind of being trained up and really understand what's going on. And we're providing best practices, which is a great thing that we've done at Carnegie. And, for you and your listeners, if you haven't looked at it, I would highly recommend looking at it, especially the capacity building toolbox that's been released. It's an incredibly useful piece of content that we just give away.
One of my students is actually in consideration for one of the scholarships through the Carnegie Endowment. So that's pretty fascinating.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, it's a great organization. I think they do some wonderful work. The other kind of interesting thing that I've noticed as I've come into this role is that, you know, I think a lot of us realize that technology is just a de facto part of day-to-day life, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not going to go away, right? And so we have to kind of think about this new normal to compare it to what we were talking about earlier around how we need to, you know, just manage as far as we manage normal day-to-day business. And there are going to be places where that's very easy and very straightforward and places where it's not. I spend a lot of time worrying about the digital haves versus the digital have-nots. If you are a digital have-not, that doesn't mean that cybersecurity doesn't impact you, right? It's at arm's length, right? And your PII is out there, no matter how much or little you choose to use digital banking technologies. We all have right. that elderly relative who refuses to use an ATM machine, and that person is still at risk. And so we still have to think about taking care of them and making sure they're protected and that the system is working for their benefit, even if they're not actively, you know, running around inside of that environment.
So what always surprises me when looking at the financial system is that it's still so much nationalized. Even here in Europe, do we have a European Central Bank? The payment systems are still different from country to country. And to the extent that they're not, they're run by two major global companies, but they still need to rely upon the underlying national systems. Is there any chance that while moving in the data economy, we're also starting to see a more internationalized banking system?
What a great question, Paul. And I worry that you're trying to get me to talk about cryptocurrency. So
that was not the intention for this question. I'm happy to talk crypto as well. But
So actually, it's a great question. And, you know, I would highlight that the massive investment in SWIFT by the People's Republic of China is something that, you know, we want to be paying close attention to as one of those organizations, right? I would say, though, that this gets back to the currency question that Kay mentioned. You know, currencies are fundamentally sovereign objects. The United States dollar is owned by the United States, et cetera, right? The euro is kind of an intriguing, and it's not new, but it was an intriguing attempt to kind of modify the one-to-one ratio there. I still think that, you know, we will fundamentally be in a singular nationalist multipolar structure, just as you described, Paul. Until, you know, we figure out if there's a way to remove sovereignty from currency, which is why, by the way, my head leaped to it being a crypto discussion, right?
Sounds like that might be a really good discussion.
I have no comment on the matter.
Because it is also out of scope for FDIC?
Mostly just because I've only been in this job a few weeks and I'm not prepared to talk about that just yet.
Perfectly fine.
I love it. Let me go to one of the statements online about the FDIC and innovation, where you're launching a rapid phase prototyping program. Can you speak on that?
It's absolutely fantastic. So this predates me, but I'm happy to talk about it. But basically, we went to the market and said, you know, we need to start looking at step change innovation across kind of everything we do as an organization. And there are a lot of private companies we work with, a lot of universities, et cetera. And we basically went and said, hey, you know, come and propose something that you think is interesting for us. And over 30 organizations did. And vetting rounded review. And I think we have 11 organizations, 11 or 12, that are currently going through phase three right now, the third phase of it. And it's just some absolutely fantastic stuff. And the creativity we've seen, the capabilities, the unbelievably fast time to markets. I mean, in a couple of cases, organizations went from kind of, hey, you're in, to showing us something really interesting in a very small amount of time, you know, 6 weeks or something like that. And it's just been an absolutely fantastic test. And, you know, for us, it's been a wonderful way to begin to kind of lift our heads up a little bit and look around and see that in 2021, there are ways of acquiring technology that are faster, more efficient, more secure, more valuable, that don't require your traditional, you know, multi-year, multi-million dollar, you know, enterprise technology acquisition contract. And it's really allowed us to lift our heads up and look at stuff. And we're already seeing, and sadly, I can't talk about it too much because obviously it's still going on, but we're already seeing places where activities inside of that program are rippling out to other parts of the organization. And it's just really exciting. It is absolutely just the first step. You will be blown away, I think, by the things we have coming. This is, as I'm quoting our chairman here, this is not your grandmother's regulatory agency. and I can't wait to talk about it more, but just not today, sadly.
Oh, that is exciting.
Well, that's always good for future conversations.
Yeah. Is privacy by design and security by design integrated into these fast deployment innovative models? How are you making sure that's happening?
Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's one of the great things about being part of the U.S. government, which still to this day is one of the best cybersecurity as an aggregate capabilities globally, if not the best. And so it's very easy for us to pull in other agencies to get that kind of quick check boxes of, hey, if you're going to participate in this, you've got to follow a basic set of rules. And we can be very strict about what those rules are, which is fantastic. Engineering resilience is something that you know, I'm saying a lot in the market. You guys will continue to hear me say this. You have to engineer resilience into these systems. You know, encryption is no longer optional. Multi-factor is no longer optional. Zero trust is no longer optional. You know, these are all things that in the world we live in, these are table stakes, right? You don't even get to walk in the door unless you're doing these things. And that's what we're doing. And we're holding them to the highest possible standards. And so I categorize everything that you just said as engineering resilience into the system. And that's exactly what we're doing.
So do you see any differences in the development of financial technology in North America versus Europe or Asia?
I mean, they're characteristically quite different environments, right? I mean, Europe has kind of a federated yet still centralized model. The few big players in Asia are quite centralized. The United States is quite federated, right? And so they are kind of characteristically different types of systems. You know, Europe has spent a lot of time recently talking about open banking, which is, you know, a very interesting philosophy, right? And when done correctly with, you know, engineered resilience, you can do some really interesting things in it. You know, it's, you know, I always like to separate out the policy from the technology. You know, and on the policy side, it's very different worlds, very different environments, right? And on the technology side, there's amazing technologies that are out there, especially in Europe, that I think are worth us, you know, exploring and looking at, but vice versa too. I mean, for a long time, the U.S. has been a net cybersecurity exporter, right? But that doesn't mean there isn't good stuff out there. And as we continue to go down this path, there's a lot of other activity. I would also highlight that, you know, there are a lot of great American companies that are exporting absolutely fantastic stuff around the world. And I really hope that continues to be something because, and this is where I can get on a little bit of a soapbox. You know, I am, unlike a lot of other people, I'm not skeptical of liberal democracies. It is the fundamental best governmental system out there. And this kind of notion that non-liberal democracies are somehow on equal footing with the rest of us, I don't trust. And so to me, European Union in particular is a critical set of partners to that. And I would love to see more collaboration. In fact, I was, you know, just this week actually working on something in that vein to find ways for us to collaborate on this topic in certain areas moving forward.
So when we are on the topic of open banking, what are technologies or features that we in Europe would have that you would wish that would work in the United States as well? What do you have any examples that could bring it to life for people?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, one of the things I think that the European Union has done in kind of an intriguing way is centralize some degree of policy decision making, right? The challenge is, I think, in both the European American cases, you know, policies are usually written by lawyers, not by computer scientists.
That doesn't sound like a bad thing, Zoltan.
Well, I know plenty of lawyers. They're lovely, lovely people. I'm actually dating a lawyer. There we go. But the nature of policymaking is evolving. And this is an area where I think maybe the U.S. is slightly ahead of our European partners, is including more technologists, people with actual technical experience and training in the discussion. I this week was on a call with an elected official who's a computer scientist, and we went down a rabbit hole on asynchronous versus synchronous messaging protocols, right? Which I you don't see quite as much of. I think in Germany we've seen a few examples of it.
Right.
But, you know, I would love to see more technical voice in the policy area. That's one specific area. On open banking, one of the nice things about open banking is it assumes that systems are interoperable and that the data is always available, right? You put controls and security around it, but that's always true. That mm-hmm. is a fundamental design tenet, I think, of all technologies in financial services moving forward. Probably more broadly than that, but let's keep it to just financial services. I would love to see higher degrees of interoperability across the various banking systems globally. It's the exception still, I think, not the rule.
Would that also speed up payments?
Absolutely, it would.
Because a bank transfer to the US currently could take up, I don't know how many weeks, whereas yeah. here in the Netherlands, it's instant yeah. now.
You know, it's interesting. And here inside the United States, there are so many different payments infrastructures out there. You know, some of them are very old school and take a few days, and others are instantaneous, right? But it is, you know, we have this massive yeah. heterogeneous network of technologies. Getting rid of some of these legacy ones, I think, would not be bad.
Not bad. So we're almost going to come to the end of our time. And so two things I want to ask you, and you can answer them in whichever order you want, but I'm going to request both. One, when you talk about lawyers being involved in the policies and you would like to see more technologists, does your consideration extend to lawyers who are the technologists or the experts on it? For example, privacy attorneys, who actually are the ones who understand the controls that need to be in place. But funny enough, a lot of companies don't have privacy attorneys or privacy officers that actually understand the technology and the controls that need to be in place. And then after that, if there was anything that when I asked you to join our show that you wanted to make sure that you shared, please make sure you do so.
So Kay, I would say that if we could clone you and put one of you inside of every bank in the United States, I would be really happy. So I hope that at least starts to answer the first question. I love having subject matter experts and functional experts put together.
Yeah.
Right. So if you are a computer scientist, but also a lawyer, that's the best of both worlds, right?
Right.
Not one or the other, right? And right now we're just getting to a point where we have both voices represented. Now,
right.
when people have internalized it and live it on a daily basis, it's great. We all know people who are, you know, contract lawyers or IP attorneys or something like that. That's great. I would love to see some combined computer science JD program, you know, from a tier one university. I think that would be amazing.
At ASU, I'm working on it, trying to get that whole data protection program yeah. built that would be business, technology, and law yeah. all together.
Yeah, we're trying to do it in Maastricht as well.
Paul yeah, and I got this plan, Sultan. We got a plan.
Well, give me up on the plan. That sounds great. I mean, we've seen business and technology come together, right? I mean, there are a number of universities, especially, I mean, I teach in a graduate program that does a really good job of combining business and technical domain experience together. Like, you can't get the degree unless you've done really well on both
right.
sides, right? Which is great. Add law, and I think you've got an amazing next thing there.
Yeah, you know, for some reason, they seem to overlook that privacy or data protection really is an important consideration. You can't just have general law. You actually need to understand data protection law.
Well, I mean, one of my favorite conversations with all my legal friends is to go deep into the bowels of a right to privacy as potentially or not potentially inside of the Fourth Amendment. So that's what I do.
When you're bored?
Yeah, exactly. In my infinite free time. I guess the only other thing I would say, and first off, thank you both for the invitation to speak with you today. This has been a lot of fun. And Kay, it's always great to see you. We've been too long since we've seen each other.
Especially since we're both in Silicon Valley, I think, at about the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you and I've lived in a number of the same zip codes. But
yeah.
The only other thing I'd say is, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of people who sit in chairs like mine don't do quite as much is actually listen to the constituency, listen to the market, listen to the average citizen. And you know, that's something I'm trying to also bring to this role. And so we have an email for anyone to just email innovation@fdic.gov that they can email to. Obviously, we're always active on social and things like that. But I really do want to hear from people. I want to hear, you know, what their concerns are, what their hopes are, you know, where they see failures and problems, and where they see success that can be replicated.
Right.
You know, you don't have to build everything yourself, You know, there's great stuff that we can just share and collaborate on. And it's, I hope that as we move into these next generations of leadership in universes like the one I'm in, that people listen a lot more and really pay attention to where people are and where they want to go. You know, I like meeting people where they are versus forcing them to come over to where I am. So the more information we have, the better we're listening. I think the better job we're doing.
I like it.
Wonderful. And maybe even you'll get some non-Americans to send you some suggestions to also bridge that gap to other jurisdictions around the world.
You know, I think that we could do a lot worse than getting thoughts and feedback from other citizens and other democracies that we're close to.
Agreed.
Thank you very much, Sultan, for joining us this week. And thanks to our listeners for joining us for another episode of Serious Privacy. If you like our series, please rate and review us in your podcast application. And do tell your friends and colleagues about us. We like to see those numbers growing. And should you have any questions or suggestions, and especially if you want to be on the program, just reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as EuroPaulB. Until next week, have a great day and goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.